We're going to start here on the bottom of Kuf Mem Vav Amud Bet, three lines from the bottom. Man Tana, the Haditana Rabbanan. Who is the author of this Braita? Who is the position that this Braita follows? He was sick. He's in his bed. Bed here referring to what's going to be his deathbed. This is a person who is a Shechiv Meira. From Rulo, they said, Dem, nechasecha to me. Where do you want your possessions to go? Where do you want them to be distributed? V'amar lahem. He said to them, Domesh ishli ben. Shav sheinli ben. I thought I had a son, or I had a son, and now that my son isn't alive anymore, or I don't have a son, nechsai leploni. Therefore all my possessions to go to so-and-so. Hayachule umutal b'mita. Same scenario again with the shchimera. V'amru lo nechasav lemi. Your possessions, it's said in the third person here, but your possessions should go to whom? Amar lahem domesh ishti meuberet. I was, at one point, I thought my wife was pregnant. Akshav shein ishti meuberet. Now that my wife is not pregnant, nechsai leploni. My possessions should go to so-and-so. Benoda sheyesh lo ben, o shehayta ishto meuberet. In the end, it was misinformation, and he did have a son, and his wife was pregnant. Ein matanato matana. His gift is not a good gift. Lema, let us say the authorship of this braita is Rabbi Shimon ben Menasiahi, Velo Rabbanan, which is the machloket that we saw before about whether you go Batar Umdana or you don't go Batar Umdana. That was the Gemara trying to understand with regards to a Shechiv Meira. When a Shechiv Meira gifts something and then passes away, the gift goes through. Shechiv Meira gifts and then survives, then the gift does not go through. They're all the qualifications we had by the Mishnah, we're going to have further on in the Gemara. He has to gift everything. He has to be in a position where it's clear that he's gifting because of death. But there we say, if he doesn't die, he reverses the entire gift. Why? He didn't say anything about dying. He didn't say anything about gifting only because he was dying. We say there was an umdana dat, that it was clear from the context and the circumstances that that was his intent. He's only gifting this because he's going to die. Had he not felt that he was going to die, he wouldn't have gifted all of his property. So therefore, when he survives, we say that's not a gift. Yesterday, we said the authorship of that position is Rabbi Shimon ben Asiyah. We brought another Tana as well. But assuming it's Rabbi Shimon ben Asiyah, he says that in the case of a Shechiv Meira, the assumption in the context is that he's gifting because of death. And then without the death, there's no gift. In our situation, the Gemara is comparing the same thing and saying, our situation is similar. He is gifting because he says, I don't have a son. He's gifting because he says, my wife is not pregnant. So, absent those items, which is the fact that he does have a son, or that his wife is pregnant, we would assume that the gift is not a viable gift. So the Gemara says, okay, you think it's Rabbi Shimon Asiyah, not the Rabbanan. Afilu teim Rabbanan. Here, even the Rabbanan could agree. Dome shiny. The dome makes it different. I'm just going to read the next line in the Gemara just to reinforce what it's saying here. Udagarila maikarila. What was the questioner thinking? The fact that here he was explicit about why he was gifting, then what's the question? For Rabbi Shimon ben Asiyah, we say it's an umdanadat. Umdanadat means that context or the situation itself gives me information that I apply and say, okay, he only meant to gift because he was dying. Over here, he was explicit about it. He said, I thought I had a son, but now I don't have a son. I thought my wife is pregnant. My wife's not pregnant. So you don't even have to guess. He's telling you why he's gifting the property, because he doesn't think he has a son. He's gifting the property because he doesn't think his wife is pregnant. And that's what the Gemara says here. What was the questioner thinking? Why wouldn't you say this is also the Rabbanan? It's so explicit in his statement that it's obvious that that's why he's gifting it. So Mao de Tema, I would have thought, Sarehu de Kamidkar, he's not premising it on this fact. He's just reminded of this painful situation in his life, that he has no heir to inherit his property. So he mentions it at the time that he's giving away his property. He doesn't mention it as a prerequisite for the fact that he will give it away, rather simply mentioning something that had happened over his lifetime that's very upsetting to him. But then he's gifting it irrespective of that statement. Kamash Malan, that we don't say that. Even the Rabbanon here would agree that Domesh Shaini, that when you make such an explicit reference, we don't suggest that it is just something that you are in pain and just mentioning that pain. It's something that you're basically premising the gift on that matter. And given that, you would have thought maybe it's only Rabbi Shimon ben Asiyah. That was what the questioner was thinking. The Kamash Malan is no. We say even the Rabbanon could be the authors of this position. Now, it's interesting over here, the way the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it. The way we read it simply is there's a difference between the Mishnah by Shechid Meirah, where he makes no reference whatsoever to dying. The context makes it obvious that he's giving it away because he is dying. Whereas in the Braita that we brought, Domeh is an explicit statement that he is doing this because of whatever matter, whether it was that he didn't have a son, that his wife wasn't pregnant. The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it is interesting. You can see it right at the towards the bottom of the Balei Tosafot in the Rabbeinu Gershom. So as he explains over here, Klomar, Domeh li ad achshav sheyesh li ben. I thought I had a son until now. Achshav she'atem shoalim. Now that you're asking me, nichsai lemi, where should my possessions go? L'divreichem k'miduma shein ben achshav. From your words, I'm getting the hint that my son no longer is alive. V'hoyo d'lo shema b'perush shemet. That the case here is a case where he didn't hear explicitly that he had passed away. Ela lefi divreichem. But it's only according to the word of those that are informing him about the information. Amar nichsai leploni. Based on that information, he gave it away. So the first thing in the Rabbeinu Gershom is that not that he knew that his son had passed away, but seemingly that these individuals are asking him, where do you want your property to go? They're the ones who informed him that his son had passed away. So now it's misinformation. It makes the case very different now. He's giving away the gift because they misinformed him about some information. That's number one. Lo akar nechasav mibno, delo hikna leploni, elefi divrehem. He only gave it away based on the words of these individuals. Therefore, it's not good matana. Of a hocha, the shamba b'feirush shemet, over here where he heard explicitly that he died, umeatzmo katvan lo, and out of his own volition, he went ahead and gave them away. Yishlamar v'day matnato matana. Then his matana is still good. Yishlamar kodem lechen gamar b'dato l'idem lezeh. He had intended to give it away even before that point in time. Avahocha dekamar domeh lo nireh shebedato ayad l'idem lo kodem lechen v'lo misik v'lo gamar. Whereas over here, it doesn't make it look like he intended to give them away because of the way that he stated it, because of the domad that is found over here. So it's very interesting that, so the Rabbeinu Gershom changes the dynamic over here. We thought that the difference simply was, how explicit is he in the gift? Whereas before, Shalach b'no l'b'niyatayam b'shamash b'no, v'amad b'katab kol nechasav. That case where his son went overseas, he hears that he died, and then he gives away all of his possessions. Over there, the Rabbanon say, he gave away his possessions. So Rabbeinu Gershom says that's because he heard the information himself. He had gotten that information. He must have intended to gift this beforehand. And this was the trigger for giving the gift. But it wasn't the reason for giving the gift. It just was, at this point, I might as well just give it away now because there's nothing else to wait for. Or I don't have to think about anything else. Whereas over here, he was only informed about the death of his son from the question of the parties that are asking, where do you want your possessions to go? He says, Kamidumali, it seems to me that my son must have passed away because you're asking me where my possessions go. So based on the Rabbeinu Gershom, the case that we saw yesterday, the initiative was the person passing away. He took the initiative, therefore it's a binding gift. Over here, where the initiative is prompted by the questioning of the other parties, that's what makes it that even the Rabbonin would agree over here that domeh shaini, that it's a different case because it's all premised on the misinterpretation of the information or the question that is being asked of him. And therefore, he comes to the wrong conclusion. It's almost as if there was a ta'ut in the basis of his statement because of that misinterpretation, that misinformation. The way we read it, according to the Rashbam, and the simpler way to read it, is the difference between whether he is explicit in the reasoning for his gift. In the other case, it's an assumption that he's gifting because he heard that his son passed away. Over here, he's explicit about the fact that his son passed away. So that would be what seemingly is the difference between them, is how explicit you are about the issue that is the pivotal issue in giving the gift. And that would be the difference. But the Rabbeinu Gershom says it has nothing to do with how explicit you are. It has to do with the nature of who's taking the initiative or the information that's given to you. So anyway, it's just an interesting point in the Rabbeinu Gershom as to the difference here, because obviously it impacts on the position of the Chachamim. That's the machlok between Rabbi Shimon ben Asya and the Rabbanon, and just that the Rabbanon in certain instances are going to agree to Rabbi Shimon ben Asya. The more explicit, the more they're going to agree. And obviously, in areas that are gray, then you have to ask the questions of how explicit it is. Tosfot references to the Gemara and Kiddushin on the previous Amud, on Daf Mem Ter Amud Bet. Over there, there's a Tosfot that breaks down cases into three different situations of Dvarim Shebelev Inam Dvarim. When do we say that whatever you thought has no impact? That's the situation over here. People are thinking something, and how binding is that to the gift? So over there, Tosafot deals with different levels of understanding, things that are almost explicit in the nature of the gift, where everybody can know that. Other cases where it's not as obvious that you want to do it, or this is the condition of the gift, and somewhere where nobody would know it without you giving them the information. So obviously in a case where without you giving them the information, they wouldn't have known it, Dvarim Shebelev, Inam Dvarim. They have no impact whatsoever. In a case from the context, it's so obvious that that's the case, then there we believe that the Dvarim Shebelev are embedded in the gift. Over there he speaks about the person who's making Aliyah and leaving for Eretz Yisrael, and he sells off all of his property, and the clarity by which, if he's leaving to Eretz Yisrael, it must be that he's selling his property because he doesn't intend to come back. And if he fails to go to Eretz Yisrael, it's pretty clear that that wasn't his intent when he sold the property. So over there, anybody looking at the situation could understand it. And then there are cases in the middle whereby it's not obvious to others, but you could maybe intuit from the situation. And over there, we're going to have a higher standard for you. You're going to have to at least articulate it. Tosafot references you to that. And here again, you have a similar idea here in the Rabbanan's position that there are different levels of explicitness with regards to the intention of your gift. It doesn't have to be absolutely explicit. It could be from context with some sort of explicit statement that may be enough to make it that you don't need an umdana. Shimon ben Asya thinks that context in of itself should be enough to always govern in these situations. Amar Rabbi Zeira, Amar Rav, minayin the matnat shechiv meira shehi min haTorah. How do we know that the gifting of a shechiv meira functions min haTorah? So now you have three different types of matnot shechiv meira. There's a matnot shechiv meira where he gives away all of his property when he's there on his deathbed. There's another matnot shechiv meira where he gives away a portion of his property when he's on his deathbed. And there's a third type, which is what's called mitzaveh mishum mita, that he's commanding them in his death, or at the point of his death, he's giving away his assets. So in the case of mitzuvah mishum mita, it's clear there that he's declaring that it's because he's dying, and he's giving it away because I'm about to die, therefore I'm giving this away. And then there's a mitzvah the kayim divrei amet. Over there, there's a mitzvah to follow through what the mate said. And the Rishbam mentioned these three areas, these three categories on the Mishnah. And he notes over here, minayin, the matnat shchimera, shukone b'dibur b'lo kinyan, sudar. How do you know that you can, through just articulation, give over a gift? Without any formal kinyan, that you can grant this item, kagon, mitzaveh machmat mita, that a person who's commanding to give it away because of his death, or in a situation where he gives away all of his property without any leftovers. So in those two cases, you simply verbalizing the fact that you want to give it away is sufficient. That's a matnat shechiv meira, he gives away all of his possessions while he is sick or ill on his deathbed. Number two is where he specifically states that he's giving it away because of his death. In those two situations, we say that whatever he says is binding. In the case where it's a partial matnat shechiv meira, there you need a kinyan, and then the question doesn't exist, because if you have to do a kinyan, then you're in the normal processes of gifting, which is a kinyan, and that kinyan then is binding. So what the Gemara is asking is, how do we know that these situations where simple stating of the fact is enough, how do we know that it works min haTorah? If you look in the Balei Tosafot, it says, la min haTorah, tavka kamar. It doesn't really mean min haTorah, it's an asmachta bi'alma. He says that matnat shechiv meira is midrabanan. The question is here, where do we know that from the Torah? Where's that asmachta min haTorah? On the other hand, it seems that from the Rashbam and others that they really think that this might be a din min haTorah. It has to do with the end of the Gemara on the Amud Bet, where the Gemara says that Rav Nachman has a position, and over there it says that Amar Rav, Amar Rav Nachman, that it's Midrabanan. The question is, do you say that they are arguing on Rabbi Zeira, or are they simply reinforcing the statement of Rabbi Zeira? And that we'll see when we get there. But at this point, you have two views, which is either he's really asking, where is it Min haTorah, Doraita, or it means the Asmachta, it's the Rabbanon, and where's the Asmachta from? Shneamar. Pasuk says, "Va'avarta min nachlato lebito." That would be ma'avir his nachala to his daughter. Yesh lecha havara acheret shehi kazu. There is another havara similar to this. Ve'ezuzo, and what is that? Matnat shechiv meira, similar to a daughter who is ma'avir nachala, because when she inherits and she gets married or she has children, the nachala will move to people other than the shevet ha'av. So too, there's another person who can do this havara without any writing. Yusha goes to the daughter without any interference. That's the next step. If there are no sons, the daughter gets the Yerusha. You don't have to do anything in order for that to happen. Similarly over here, you don't have to do anything formal for this other Havara to take place. What is generating the limud over here? Obviously, is something extraneous in the pasuk. The Rabbeinu Gershom says, the meimer v'natatem et nachlato. It should have said, v'natatem and not v'avartem. Avartem is havara, is to move. V'natatem means that you give it to that child. Why does the Torah use the word havara instead of v'natatem? He claims that that's the extraneous language over here from which they learn there must be another havara. That other havara is the havara v'yishchid meira. The Rashbam over here, the last of the options he brings up is what the Rabbeinu Gershom says, and he rejects that. Because we're going to see in a second in the Gemara thinks the word netatem is also extraneous. That the word netatem is unnecessary as well. So saying that vavartem is unnecessary, it doesn't make sense. You should have written netatem. He says even if you wrote netatem, it's extraneous. So he rejects that. He brings from the Beinu Chananel that et nachlato is the riboy, the et is extra. He rejects that as well. And he says that the havartem yeterahu. You don't need the word avartem. You could have just simply said, Ave matzli mechtav ish kiamut, ubein ein lo, nachlato lebito. You don't need a verb in that case. You could just tell us who the object of the nachala is. Is it your son? If there's no son, then it's your daughter. And you didn't need a verb there at all. So that's what the Rashbam believes, that avartem is completely unnecessary. Not that you could have written netatem, completely unnecessary. Rabbeinu Gershom thinks that it's avartem instead of netatem. And the Rabbeinu Chanano says it's et nachalato. Achman amar rabo baravu meocho. He says it's from here. Unetatem nachalato leachav. That if there's no daughter, then you give that nachala to the brothers. So yesh lecha netina acheret sheikazo. Again, you have another giving that is similar to this. So now here, it's clear, and this is the Rashbam's proof, that the word netatem here is extraneous. Now, for the Rabbeinu Chananel, it's going to be et nachalato. Again, he's going to say the et is the extra word. But for the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says, oh, you didn't have to write v'natatem nachalato. You could have just written v'tiyeh nachalato. And that's similar to what the Rashbam says over here. But the Rashbam says, im ein lo bat nachalato le'achav. You could just leave out the verb completely. Because for him, he thinks that v'natatem is extraneous as well, just like v'avartem. For the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says you could fill in with a different verb. Vati'i nachlato le'achav. You don't have to say v'natatem. So he thinks that the usage of the language, or the change in the language, is what is extraneous here, according to the Rabbeinu Gershom. Now the Gemara says, Rav Nachman ma'itayim alo amar me'avartem. Why didn't Rav Nachman accept the suggestion of Rabbi Zeira that it comes from v'avartem? Ha'om ibayle the rabbi. He needs that for Rabbi's limud that we saw earlier in the Masechta, the Tanya, back on Kuftet, the Mudbet, Rabbi Omer. All of the nachalot in the parshia say unetatem, but the daughter it says havara. That's because the daughter moves nachala from shevet to shevet. The proof from that is hobna ubala yorshimota. That's how Rabbi knows. How do you know that a husband inherits his wife? How do you know that a son inherits his mother? Because of avartem nachalato, that the nachala passed to a daughter will move from shevet to shevet. The only way that happens is if the nachalah that she gets goes to her husband or to her son or from the alternate shevet, meaning that her son, by definition, will be from the shevet of the father, and the father is her husband. So that will be havarat nachalah. That is his limud. That is his source for the fact that a baal and a child inherit the wife and the mother. Reb Zeira maitaim alo amar v'unetatem. Why doesn't he learn it out of v'unetatem? Orchei dikrau. He says that's the way that the pasuk speaks. You're right. You could have said v'tiyeh. Could have left it out entirely. But it's a literary style of the Torah to write unetatem. That's the way the Torah writes. It'll repeat the verb over and over again. And therefore, he doesn't make anything out of it. He only makes something out of avartem versus v'netatem. Right? Rav Menashe bar Yirmiyahu amar mehocha. You can learn it out of here from the posuk in Melachim Bet, where Chizkiyahu HaMelech falls ill, and Yishayahu informs him that he's going to die from this illness. V'yamim ha'im chala Chizkiyahu lamut. He was on his deathbed. Vayavo elav Yishayahu ben Amoz Navi. Yishayahu the Navi comes to him. Vayomer elav, ko amar Hashem, tzav lebeitecha. You should give your last will and testament. Ki meit ata v'lo tichye. You are going to pass away and not survive from this illness. And we know that Chizkiyahu HaMelech then turns towards the wall and davens. And the Gemara and the Chazal say that he says, I have a mesorah from my grandparents, my great-grandparents, David HaMelech, I mean, I have a mesorah from David HaMelech, that tefillah can always help. And therefore he rejects what Yishayahu ben Amoz says, and he davens to Hashem and survives this illness. But you see what he said to him, it's tzav lebeitecha. He didn't say, give it out, give it kinyanim. He said, command, you should distribute your assets based on your tzivui. Rabbi Bar Yechezkel Amar, mehocha, you can say it from here. Vachitofil ra'a, kilo ne'esta atzatot. This is in Shmuel Bet. At the time that Avshalom is leading the rebellion against David HaMelech, Achitofel is one of the advisors to Avshalom. And Achitofel is always right. He's a strategist that always gets it right. So now Avshalom is listening to him, and he also has Hushai Arki advising him. Hushai Arki is a plant of David HaMelech who stayed back in Yerushalayim and is trying to upend the advice of Achitofel, because David knows if Achitofel keeps giving advice to Avshalom, he's finished. So he wants someone to interfere. And that's what Hushai Arki does, is that he convinces Avshalom not to listen to Achitofel. And given that, he sees, Achitofel says, lo nasta astato, he sees that his advice, his strategy is not taken. Vayechavoshet ha-chamor, he saddles his donkey. It's missing here the word. It says, vayakam, vayelech el beito. He goes ahead, goes home, el yiro, to his city. Vayitzav el beito. He commands his family as to what to do. Vayichanak. And then he commits suicide. He chokes himself. He hangs himself. Bitzava ba'alma. Once again here, there were, it says, vayelech el beito, vayitzav el beito. That he just was tzava, the modern word for I will. Is it tzava? But that's what you're saying here, that the commandment to the people, I mean, his distribution of the assets was happening through a tzava, not through written documentation, or through a kinyan. So from these different psukim you see over here, that there is this idea or concept of passing Yerusha through simply articulation or tzava, not by doing it through any formal kinyan of any sort. So now, if you use the latter psukim, then it's much more obvious that we're not speaking about something d'oraita, because there you're bringing psukim from Divrei Nevi'im. So once you do that, that already makes it much clearer that you think that it's not a din d'oraita, and these are just a smachtot bi'alma. Whereas, if you use the first two psukim, which are min haTorah, there you could argue whether it's d'oraita or an asmachta, because you are using psukim of the Torah. And just as a general note, the fact that the Gemara looks for so many different sources, or brings so many different sources down for it, that's generally an indication of, I would either call it uncertainty as to the right answer over here, or if it's d'oraita, it's usually more obvious as to where the d'oraita derives from. The fact that you have multiple answers already makes it more questionable whether it is d'oraita, and seems to lean more heavily to where what the Tosafot say, that it's an asmachta. And at Smachta, you have looser rules about how you learn it out and where you learn it out from, and that would make it more probable given the number of answers that we're getting to this question. Tanrabanan. Shlosha dvarim tziva Achitofel et banav. Achitofel commanded his children in these three matters. Al tiyu b'machloket. Don't be involved in altercations. So that's an interesting statement, because this week is Parshat Korach. And in Parshat Korach, there is a tzivoy, lo tiyek Korach ve'adato, that there should not be like Korach and his group. There the Rishonim argue as to whether that is a statement of fact, that Hashem is saying that I made sure through this whole incident that there won't be people who question the kahuna anymore. And how is that? You're going to put together a cover for the Mizbeach that will be a reminder that people will not question the kahuna. That's a simple way to read it. Other Rishonim read it as a tzivoy. Lo tiyek korach v'adato means you may not act like korach adato, which means you may not engage in machloket. You may not get involved or persist in machloket, different ways that the Rishonim formulated. So it's only interesting because over here you have al tiyu b'machloket. So al tiyu b'machloket also has a similar ring to it, which is it's not clear. Sometimes you can't avoid in getting into altercations. Al tiyu b'machloket you can read as al tishahu b'machloket. Don't stay in a machloket. Meaning if there is an altercation, try to resolve it as quickly as possible, or do not dwell or persist in machloket. That's one way you can read it. The other way to read it is al tiyu b'machloket is to avoid it completely. And both of those are fair readings over here in terms of machloket. And that's a similar way that the Rishonim argue about lo tiyek korach v'adato, is that if you believe it is a tzivoy not to get involved in altercations, what is the tzivoy? Is the tzivoy not to persist? not to allow for resolution of arguments, or is it not to enter into arguments at all? Valtim rodu b'melchut beit David. Obviously, Achitofel from personal experience says it's not worthwhile rejecting or rebelling against Malchut beit David. Yom tov shel atzeret barur zaru chitim. On Yom Tov of Atzeret, now it's interesting here, Atzeret means two things. Atzeret in the Torah only references to one day, and that is Shmini Atzeret. The Chachamim also added in the additional meaning of Atzeret to Shavuot, which is the way that we call it, but that's all rabbinic imposition. Obviously, it connects to the idea that Shavuot is the eighth day of Pesach, that the Ramban of the Torah brings down, that the days in between, the sphere in between is the Chol HaMoed, and that Shavuot is the eighth day. So Chazal saw in Shavuot and Atzeret similar to Shmini Atzeret. But in the Torah, you'll never find the word Atzeret used in relationship to Shavuot. So now, Yom Tov Shel Atzeret, you could read as referring to Shmini Atzeret, or you can read it as referring to Shavuot. All the Rishonim here, you look at the Rabbeinu Gershom, you look at the Rishbam, read it as referring to Shavuot, and that might be because of the opposing opinion later on. It's not clear to me that that's the case. I think you could read it as Shmini Atzeret over here. And the connections, as we'll see in a second, is that b'Shavuot nidonim ala tvua, and b'Sukkot nidonim ala mayim. So those are the two inputs to a great productive year. One is the rain, and the other one is the tvua. So Shavuot and Sukkot are relevant in terms of the success of the tvua in the upcoming year. We'll follow the position of the Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rashbam that it's referring to Shavuot. It says here that if Shavuot is a clear day, Zaru Chitim, on that upcoming year, you should plant wheat. So that would make sense to me if it was by Shmini Atzeret, only because by Shmini Atzeret, you're right before the planting season, it would make a lot of sense. But anyway, they learned it Atzeret, you're referring to Shavuot. Mazutra Mar, Balulit Mar. So this is how what happens to a Masorah like this. He says, no, if it's a cloudy day, it's a not a clear day, then you should plant wheat. There, the whole Siman's gone now. We have a machloket as to whether it's a clear day or a cloudy day, then nobody knows what you should do. So Amrei Naradai, Mishmei de Rabbi Yaakov, Lo Barur Barur Ma'amash. When it says it's a clear day, it doesn't mean a fully clear day. Lo Balul Balul Ma'amash. When it's saying it's a cloudy or an overcast day, it doesn't mean fully overcast. Ella, Afilu Balul Veruach Tzvonet Minashavato. That if it is a overcast or a cloudy day and the northerly wind comes and blows it away and moves the clouds out, Zehu Barur. That's the equivalent of Barur. So we're expanding the view as to what the word Barur means over here. It doesn't only mean a very clear day. It means a day that is cloudy, but the clouds are cleared up to the point where it eventually becomes a clear day. So Amalei Rabbi Yahavo, the Rav Ashi, Ana Ana, the Rav Yitzchak, Bar Avdimi, Matnitan La. We rely on the Siman that is given to us from Yitzchak, Bar Avdimi. You speak about that, is the Siman. We have a different Siman. Amar Rav Yitzchak, Bar Avdimi, Motzei Yom Tov Achron Shel Chag. It seems to be the night after, but probably it means the next day, based on, you'll see what the siman is. The next day, after Shemini Atzeret, Hakol Tzofim Lashana Maracha. Everybody looks up at the smoke of the maracha, of the pyre that's there. Nata Klape Tzafon, if it leans towards the northern side. So over here, the Gemara and Yom already asked the question, don't we have a Mishnah and a vote that says that the 10 miracles that happened by the Beit HaMikdash were that the below, that the wind never moved the smoke of the maracha. All of a sudden here, they're looking for a siman based on which direction the wind is blowing. So the Gemara there answers that the wind did not have an impact. It went up straight, but it was noteh. It leaned in a certain direction. So it wasn't that the ruach came and dispersed it and spread it all over the place, but as the ashana is going up straight, there it tilts to one side or the other side. And that's an indication of the wind. So if it's tilting klapei tzafon, it's going northerly. That means that the southern wind is taking up. Aniim smeichim ubalei batim atzuvim. That the aniim are happy and the balabatim are upset. Mipnei shegishmei shana mirubim. Because then they're going to have a ton of rain and moisture, humidity. Uperot markivim. And therefore, anything that's in the storehouse needs to be sold out. You can't keep things in the storehouse because they're going to go bad because of the moisture and the rain that is going to come. And so therefore, you're forced to sell it now and not hold out to a later period. That's good from the aniim because that brings the prices down. They're not withholding from the market and storing things for later. They have to empty out their silos. So that's number one. Number two is then they're going to have, the rain will help with the upcoming crops. That means that there's going to be plenty of food and prices are going to depreciate. So that's great for the aniim. For those that are trying to make their living doing this, it's a much harder situation. Natal klapei darom. On the other hand, if the ashan is leaning towards the south, which means you have a northerly wind, aniim atzuvim, then the poor are upset. Ubalibatim smechim, and the homeowners are happy. I would say that the contrast between them is that the aniim are net buyers of food, and the balibatim are net sellers of food. I mean, they're the producers. They're the ones who own the farms. The aniim are poor. They don't own property. They're not producing. They have to buy from the market. So that's their aniim. So one is a net taker of price, and one is a net offerer of price. Mipnei shegishmei shana muatim. In that case, the geshem is going to be light. There's not going to be heavy rain. Peirot mishtamrim. It's going to be a drier season. The drier season is going to make it that which is in the silo will be fine. That means they can store food. They don't have to empty out the silos. And the way that the Rishpam explains it, there will be sufficient rain to have crops. It won't be a bumper crop, but there'll be sufficient rain to have crops. So the Balabatim will have what to sell, but prices will hold. Because, first of all, they don't have to empty out their silos. And number two is, the crops are not going to be these bumper crops. It'll be a normal-sized crop, and it will not put pressure on pricing. Nata klape mizrach. It leans towards the eastern side, which means that it's a westerly wind. Hakol smechim. Then everyone is happy. Klape marav. If it leans towards the west, which means it's an easterly wind, hakol atzuvim, then everyone is upset. Over here, it's not clear whether why everybody's happy or why everybody's upset. The way the Rashbam reads it is in the case where it is the eastern side where everybody is happy, meaning that the westerly wind came, it's because there's going to be a lot of rain. And that lot of rain is going to make it that there is a bumper crop, but that lot of rain will be beneficial to both sides here. It'll be enough rain that it will be good for the aniim. The prices will be steady. There'll be plenty of food. But it'll be such a bumper crop that the balabatim, even at the lower prices, they'll make up in volume what they couldn't get in price. So that would be the idea through the Rishbam. And the opposite is true in the other case, where there's not enough rain that the crops are going to be hurt by the lack of rain. Then even the balabatim, the prices will appreciate, but the balabatim won't be able to take advantage of that because they don't have crops to give. That's the way that the Rishbam learns it. If you look in the Balei Tosafot later on in the Gemara, when the Gemara gives an answer, Tosafot says that he thinks that that's not right. He says, Perish Rabbein Shmuel, Deruch Mizrachit Monat Et HaMatar. He says that the easterly wind stops the rain. And that's what we said here. When it's moving towards the west and there's an easterly wind, everybody's upset because there is a lack of rain. And the Tosafot says, you could say just the opposite. He says, Alkei Nira, Dinifarish Demeviyamayim. It's the other way around. That the reason everybody's upset is when there's excessive rain. When there's excessive rain, it ruins the crops. Too much rain over there, it ruins everything that's there. So then, first of all, the prices are up, and the balabatim have nothing to sell. So the aniim are upset, and so are the balabatim. On the other hand, in the case of when it moves toward the east, which is a westerly wind, the Rashbam said that was good because there was a lot of rain. The Tosafot says that it's good because there is the right amount of rain. It's a minimal amount of rain. So then everybody's happy because you get the crops that you want, and the balabatim have what to sell. The westerly wind is positive according to the Rishbam because it brings lots of rain, according to the Balei Tosafot because it brings just the right amount of rain. It brings less than, it brings a drier season in which there'll be good crops and proper amount of rain. Whereas the easterly wind, according to the Rishbam, is that there's too little rain. According to the Tosafot, it means there's too much rain. Right now, the Gemara says, Viriminhi, is that really true? Mizrachit, the olam yafeh. We have a brayta that states that the easterly wind is always good. In the previous brayta, it said the easterly wind was negative. Al kol atzuvim, everybody was upset. Marvit olam kashe. And we said the westerly wind in this brayta says is always bad. Yet in the previous brayta, we said the westerly wind results in everyone being happy. So there, first of all, it's clear that you have a stira here between the eastern and western winds over here, between this brayta and the previous brayta. Ruach tzvonit yafeh lechitim b'shah sheviu shlish. The northerly wind is good for the wheat if they've already grown one-third of their maturity. And it's poor or difficult for the olives once they have already blossomed or once they've already started to emerge. It's like it's good for one crop and bad for the other crop. Over here, seemingly, this does not disagree with what we said before. Because over here, it's saying that the ruach tzfonit is positive for the chitim. And even though before we saw that the dromit was more positive in terms of production and higher production before, that was talking about when you're planting the wheat. Over here, you're talking about wheat that's already a third of its maturity. In that case, if you have too much rain, once it's already grown really a third of its maturity, that's negative for the crops. You want it to remain relatively dry once the crops have emerged to a certain point, because otherwise it just ruins them and causes them to rot. So therefore, when it said before, when you had a tzvonit wind, that was negative because there was a lack of rain. That lack of rain is beneficial for the emerged wheat already. Bad for the olives because the olives are still in a immature state. And the other way around, which is that if you have ruach dromit, if you have a southerly wind, which we said above was brought a lot of rain, then kasher lechitim mishashaviu shlish, it's negative for the wheat that's already emerged to a third of its maturity. But it's good for the olives who are in a more immature state because the rain is helpful for them to continue their growth and to mature. If you read the Braita that way, then the only stira between the first Braita and the second Braita is Maravit and Mizrachit, which seem to be Soter Achad Tesheni. The other hand, if you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says that even the Tzvonit and the Dromit are problematic because he said before that the Tzvonit, the wind that came from the Tzvon, we said was Aniim Atzuvim. The Aniim were upset because it wasn't good for the wheat. And now we're saying that the Yeruch Tzvonit is good for the wheat. And he sees a steer in that. I reconciled it by saying it's a difference. Over here, the Braita seems to say that it's only because it's past a certain point of maturity that it's negative. That means early on it would have been positive. And that's the easy way to reconcile it. The Rabbeinu Gershom doesn't do that and sees a steer out throughout. The only problem with the mentioning is that the Gemara, when it answers, only answers or seems to answer the difference between the Mizrachit and the Maravit. It doesn't seem to address the Tzafon v'Darom. What you would have to say for him is that that answer also answers the Tzafon and Darom, even though the Rabbeinu Gershom himself never mentions what the answer to that question is. How do you remember this? Shulchan b'Tzafon and Menorah b'Darom. The Shulchan is placed in the Kodesh on the northern side. The menorah is on the southern side. We saw this already earlier in the Masechta, whereby that is a siman that a person, a rotzeh la'ashir, a person wants to get rich, yatzpin, should go north. A rotzeh lachkim, someone wants to become wise, yadrim, should go south. The simanech, the siman is the shulchan b'tzafon, which represents parnasa. Menorah b'darom, which represents chuchma and torah. Here the Gemara uses it in a different way, which is the simanech shulchan b'tzafon menorah b'darom is a high menorah b'diday, high menorah b'diday. Each one takes care of its own. The shulchan, the bread on the shulchan, is a product of the wheat. Therefore, the northerly wind takes care of the wheat, the shulchan, which is in the north. The southerly wind is good for the olives, which is what is used to make the oil for the menorah. And therefore, the menorah in the south, the southerly wind is positive for the olives that are the product used by the menorah. So that's the siman. My answer is, there's no stira between the breito, lokasha, halan, haluhu. This is an answer that's given throughout Shas. You can see that the Mesorta Shas already points you to brachot, where the Gemara gives that answer. It's brought in Kiddushin and other places in Shas. That's for us, that's for them. Here we're speaking about the Talmud Bavli. So Talmud Bavli says, that's for us, that's for them, means those that are in Eretz Yisrael. The Breitfeld are speaking about different situations. One speaking about a situation in Eretz Yisrael, one speaking about the situation in Bavel. Many times when you have this answer, it's not always clear which is the halan and which one is the halahu. Which way does it go? And this is no exception. In the Gemara in Brachot, as well as the Gemara in Kiddushin, the Balei Tosafot argue on Rashi there as to which one is the halan halahu. They have opposite positions as to which one belongs to Bavel and which one belongs to Eretz Yisrael. And similarly over here, the Balei Tosafot, this is what I noted before, had a different reading of Mizrachit and Maravit, come up with an opposite answer to the Rabbeinu Gershom, the Rashbam over here. You can see this in the Rashbam. It's the third to last line in the Rashbam. The Bnei Bavel, Shochnim b'mitzula. For the Bnei Bavel that live in the valleys, live in land that is flat and low-lying. Ve'artzenu meluch lechet. And our land is already moist. We have plenty of moisture. We have plenty of water that's provided even without the rain. Ve'en etzrichal matar kol kach. We don't need so much rain. Lididan mitnaya breita batraita. For us, the second breita is relevant. The second breita that says that the ruach mizrachit is va'olam yafeh, that the easterly wind is always good because the easterly wind brings less rain. And in Bavel, they wanted less rain because too much rain would ruin everything. They already had enough moisture and water that they didn't need the rain. It makes some sense because then the easterly wind is probably coming over the desert, brings a drier air, and the westerly winds bring from the sea, the Mediterranean, and from that side, and bring a moisture or a heavier rainfall on the westerly side. It's possible. So based on that, the Rashbam says that for the easterly wind is positive for Bavel because they need less rain and it brings less rain. Similarly, in Eretz Yisrael, the easterly wind which brings less rain is negative for Eretz Yisrael, and that's the first breita. And the opposite way around. The second brayta that says that the westerly wind is negative is because it brings a lot of rain. For Eretz Yisrael in the first brayta, that's positive. In the second brayta, it's negative for Bavel because it's just too much rain. They don't need that much rain. So they have different perspectives. Bavel has a perspective on rain, which is we have plenty of moisture, water, natural water in the ground, as well as water sources, and therefore we don't need so much rain. Eretz Yisrael is up in the mountains. It's a higher lying area and has less natural water resources without the rain. They're very dependent on the rain. The Torah makes that clear. And therefore, the more rain that comes, the better off we are in that situation. So that is the answer that the Rashbam gives. If you look in the Rabbeinu Gershom, he says the exact same thing. That the second Braita is the one that refers to Bavel, and the first Braita refers to Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, the way that the Tosafot is explaining it, it seems that he means the other way around. Because he says that Rabbeinu Shmuel, when he said that the easterly wind causes there to be less rain, that's the wrong way to explain it. The problem with the easterly wind is not that it brings less rain, but rather, Balei Tosafot said that's not the case. The easterly wind brings too much rain, and that's why everybody is upset, because it's too much rain. So then, if that's the case, then you would seemingly say that the first Braita refers to Bavel, because in the first Braita, Mizrachit refers to too much rain, and that's why everybody's upset. Maravit refers to just the right amount of rain, and there they are, Smechim. The opposite of what is in the latter Braita. The latter Braita that says Mizrachit lo miyafeh, that's referring to Eretz Yisrael. They want a ton of rain. And the Maravit is kasheh because it brings less rain. So from that, or the way that the Tosfot explains it, it seems to be that Tosfot thinks the first Braita is referring to Bavel, and the second one to Eretz Yisrael, and vice versa for the Rashbam and the Reino Gershom, who think the second Braita is about Bavel, and the first Braita is about Eretz Yisrael. Again, the idea or the concept is the same between them. It's just a question of whether the westerly wind or the easterly wind does this, is that the one that brings more rain is positive for Eretz Yisrael and negative for Bavel, and the one that brings less rain is negative for Eretz Yisrael and positive for Bavel. All right. Amar Rav Zvid, Hai Yom Kama Dereish Shato, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, I chamim, if it's a hot day, kula shata chamima, then the whole year is going to be a hot year. I karir, if it's a cooler day, kula shata karira, then the whole year is going to be a cool year. L'may nafkamina. Why does it matter if it's going to be hot or cold? It doesn't really make a difference. You can't do much about that. And it doesn't really affect the crops. You're going to plant them either way. It says, the tefilato shel kohen gadol. The tefilah of the kohen gadol, Yom Kippurim, after he goes into the Kodesh Kodeshim, on his way out, he says a tefillah ktzara. We say that tefillah in Chazarat Hashatz and Musaf, when we speak about the Avoda and the Yom HaKippurim. Over there, we also speak about the tefillah ktzara that the Kohen Gadol said. In Yoma, it describes exactly what his tefillah was when he exited, and it had to do with the crops, and about the rain that they needed, whether that it should be dry or should be rainy, whatever it is he was speaking about. So Gemara here says that, well, if you have this siman, he knows what to daven for. And that's what the Balei Tosafot say. If it's a siman that's going to be a hot year, he should daven that it shouldn't be too hot. That it shouldn't be extremely hot. It should be hot, but not too hot. And if it's going to be cold, it should be cold, but not extremely cold. That it should daven to mitigate the extremes in either of these situations. You could easily see it as just not only just mitigating the extremes, but if it is going to be a hot year, you should daven that it be cooler. And if it's going to be a cool year, you should daven it should be hotter. Not mitigating the extremes, but trying to bring it back to the middle ground. Okay, now, Virova Amar Rav Nachman Matnat Shchimera Midrabanan Be'almahi. Rav Amar Rav Nachman over here seemingly says that Matnat Shchimera Zirabonon Shema Titaref Dato Alav. Because maybe he will lose his mind. We'll see in a second. The Rashbam brings two perushim as to what this means. But here you see from Rav Amar Rav Nachman, if he thinks Matnat Shchimera is Midrabanan, that implies when Rabbi Zera said it was Midoraita, that seemingly it means Midoraita versus Midrabanan. That will have to depend, the Marsha says, on the Vav here. If you're Goreis the Vav, then it means that he is arguing on the previous statement. And so there, Rav Amar Rav Nachman is saying that I disagree with Rabbi Zeir who says it's Midoraita, and I say it's Midrabanan. If you leave out the Vav, then Rav Amar Rav Nachman, Manach Shimei Midrabanan, is a new statement. It's not arguing on Rabbi Zeir, it's making a statement. That statement might be in concert with what Rabbi Zeir said before, and that's the way the Balei Tosafot read it, which is that Rav Amar Rav Nachman is not saying anything different. Rabbi Zeir was just saying, where's the Asmachta from? But here, Rav Amar Rav Nachman is telling you what the halacha is, that's only Midrabanan, and the reason behind the din derabanan, and that is shalot itareif dato, that the person should not lose his mind. So Rashbam at first brings down a explanation that it means gezera. Shema she'ad yavo edim laknot titaref tato shol chule. This is what you've been asking me a number of times. He says that the reason we want it to work is because if he's ready to give his last will and testament, and we go out and have to go find edim in order for it to be binding, he might lose his mind in the meantime. He might become delirious. He might lose his capacity to gift. So in order to preempt that, when he is of sound mind still, we allow him to gift and not go through the whole process or protocol, because there's a risk in going through the process or protocol, which is that he will no longer be of sound mind and not gift properly. The Rashbam says, that's wrong. V'kashali, ma bakach im tevatel miachar she'enu koneh b'amira tevatel v'tevatel. He says, if that's the reason, if it doesn't work, meaning that amira is not sufficient, and we're worried about the amira not being sufficient because by the time they go to get somebody, he will lose his mind. But if amira in and of itself is not sufficient, he says, what's the big deal? So he couldn't gift it. It was only a takanat chachamim anyway, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. So if he lost his mind, he can't gift it and let Yusha the Torah to kick in. So he doesn't see that as being a sufficient reason to have the chachamim institute something. All they're saying is, oh, in the meantime, he lost his mind, he won't be able to gift. Okay, so he won't be able to gift. Why is that an issue? Ella, lishna achrina mefarshinan b'nira b'einai. He says there's another reason, and I think this is the right reason, which is, shemein dvarav niknim, if we don't allow it, his last will and testament to go through, chashinan shemati tareif dato b'chol yo, that it will cause his situation to deteriorate. It'll make him more sick. It will ruin him mitoch tzar, out of the pain that he can't distribute the assets the way he wants to. So that's what the Rashbam views as being the right way to reach into Taref Tato. The institution of the Chachamim was for the health of the individual, the mental health of the individual. This person is losing their mind. They are very ill. They're on their deathbed. And so we don't want to accelerate that process from the angst about not being able to distribute his assets and having to wait to get people there and to write it down. So we give him a right to distribute it orally, because in that way it will keep him at ease, give him peace of mind. That peace of mind will make it easier for him and prolong his life. And that's what it means, because of Shemati Tareif Dato Alav. So Rashbam sees that as the direct cause for the Takana, rather than the fear that if we wait, that he won't be able to gift, because if we wait and he's not able to gift, fine. That's the halacha. The halacha is you can't gift orally. So why should we worry about that? That if he loses his mind, he can't gift orally. That would have been fine. So that's why he says he favors the second reasoning, which is that it would be detrimental to the health of the individual if we don't allow him to gift in this manner. Umi amar Rav Nachman hochi. Did Rav Nachman really say such a thing? So here, this is a little play with the girsa. If it's ha'amar Rav Nachman afagav, or the way that the Bach says that the Rashbam had the girsa was ha'amar Rav Nachman amar Shmuel. That Rav Nachman says in the name of Shmuel, de amar Shmuel, ha'mocher shtarchov lechaveiro. Person who sells a shtarchov to his friend, v'chazaru mechalo, machol. If he then afterwards forgives the loan is forgiven. Va'afilu yoresh mochel. Even a yoresh can forgive the loan. So over here, it's a question as to why this works. We actually just discussed this recently, that if one grants the right of collection to another party, the new party has a right of collection, but the original party, the party who the loan was originally given by, has a right to forgive it even after he has sold it. The question is why that is the case. So many believe that is because the ability to sell a loan is only a din derabbanan. It's a din derabbanan. The rabbanan said that you could sell a loan, but that is limited in its scope, and that is that you could sell the loan, but the original party can forgive the loan. Because it's derabbanan, that is the case. On the other hand, there are those that believe that it is d'oraita, but the reason that you can be mochel over here has to do with, it's a sheet of the Rabbeinu Tam, you can see it in the Rashbam here as well, which is that every loan has two aspects to it, two parts to it. And that is that you have the loan itself, the outstanding obligation to repay the loan, and then there's what's called the shibudei. The shibud is not just the obligation to give it back or to pay back the loan, but the encumberment of the loan. The loan says that the person is encumbered to the repayment of the loan. And that encumberment on the person also encumbers his assets to repay the loan. But that means that you have a hold on this individual, not just on his assets, but on the individual himself. So what he can sell is, he can sell the right of collection. The zchut, or that right, is the ability to sell. The shibud that exists is a personal matter between the creditor and the debtor, and that's not something that can be sold. And you can see this in the Rashbam, first the wide lines, machul. Dolo machor lo rishon the sheni el kol zchut shetavel liyado. The first party, the creditor, can only sell to the collection agency what rights he has. Dolo adif alokeach mimalve. He can't be greater than the creditor himself. Da'date machmate the malve. Because he's derivative of the creditor. He is gaining his rights through the creditor. Umiu ma'tov yachzir lamocher lelokeach. Says, but nevertheless, if he does such a thing and forgives the loan, the person who forgives the loan's got to give back the money that he took from the other party to buy the collections. When you cause that loss, it's the equivalent of burning up someone else's shtar. Now, you just burn paper. It happens to be that the paper's worth a lot because of what's written on it. But that's a din in garmi. That's not a din in direct damage. So given that you can't bring him to court because of Nezek, but you can bring him to court if you're dan dine de garmi. If you believe that garmi is subject to court enforcement and it obligates a person to pay, like when you burn someone's shtarot, so to over here, where you ruin the right of collection that you sold to the other individual, then when it's forgiven, you're going to have to repay him for the losses that you caused him to incur. And then in next Rashbami writes, same thing again, that by the Yoresh, that the Yoresh inherits his father, but the rights that were sold to the buyer here were only the rights of collection. And then he says the line that means everything is, ach lo ne'akar shibudo min amalveh. The shibud that was generated between the debtor and the creditor never leaves the creditor. The creditor can't sell that connection or that encumberment of the debtor towards him. He can't sell that. He can sell rights of collection. He can't sell the shibud. And based on that, the Rabbeinu Tam and similarly the Rashbam, his brother, both say that when you sell the loan, it works. Midoraita. Midoraita, you're able to sell the right of collection. But that's the problem. You can only sell the right of collection. What you can't do is sell the right of shibud. That right of shibud is a relationship that was generated at the time that the loan was extended, and that relationship can't be sold because it's about the personal obligation of the debtor towards the creditor. And that you can't sell because that's something that is generated by the issuance of the loan, not something that exists because of the loan. And therefore, you can sell him the right of collection, but you maintain that shibud. And if you forgive the shibud and you're mochel on that shibud, the shibud will then disappear and the obligation to repay would disappear, even though the right of collection was sold. And that's why it works. And a yoresh functions in the same way. A yoresh is not simply passage of property to him, but rather he steps into the shoes of the bequeather. So in stepping into the shoes of the bequeather, he can take over that relationship with the debtor. He can take over that shibud. Because that's something that's passed through Yerusha, that's not something that can be sold. And therefore, according to these Rishonim, you could even have the michira, or the sale of a shtar, be done de'oraita. Despite the fact that it's sold de'oraita, you could still have it be machul, you could still be the original party could forgive it, because of the shibud that's left behind. Other Rishonim believe that it's all, and that's what the Gemara is going to say something similar now, it's all because it's a din de'rabbanan. Since it's a din de'rabbanan, therefore, you can forgive the loan afterwards, because in essence, midoraita, the creditor is still the real owner of the loan, only midorabanan, they passed it to the other party. So now, that has impact on a number of things. I'll just mention a couple of them right now. One of them is the fact that earlier on in the Masechta that we saw in Daf Ayin Vav, whether you have the ability to sell a shtar, or you have an ability to give over a shtar to another party, and there the Gemara discussed whether you have to write another shtar in order to grant the rights of this shtar. And so this issue plays in there. The Rishonim over there who think the ability to sell over there that shtar through Mesira and then the writing of another shtar, is that d'oraita or is that the Rabbanon? Many of them are influenced by this situation here where the Malve sells the right of collection and then is able to be Mochel afterwards. From there they bring evidence as to the fact that it's the Rabbanon, and those that say it's d'oraita say no, you can separate out the issues and therefore the selling of a shtar is d'oraita. So that sugya, back in Ayin Vav, is affected by the way that you view the sugya over here. Number two is, there is a halacha of a mamad shloshtam. Mamad shloshtam is something that we learned just recently, a kinyan, that if you have the creditor, the debtor, and the party that's recipient, if all three of them are present, You can then give that over to the other party, and it's binding. How binding is that? So according to those that believe that the din of selling alone is d'oraita, and just you can't give over the shibud, it seems that in mamad shloshtam, you're able to overcome that problem. In mamad shloshtam, the debtor now re-encumbers himself to the new party, because he's present when this transaction takes place. Since all parties are present, that makes it that the shibud now is re-entered with the new party, and you can sell it d'oraita. And you can do that d'oraita with mamad shloshtam. That's why mamad shloshtam works. It works because it's d'oraita, and that's their proof that you can sell a loan d'oraita because it works by mamad shloshtam. Then the Ramban over there says it's not necessarily the case. It could be that the selling of a shtar or the outstanding obligations is only midrabanan. Mamad shloshtam works midrabanan also. Midrabanan, they instituted it. Mamad shloshtam would have a tokev k'd'oraita, and it would be a binding transaction by which the original party would not be able to forgive. So even though halakhically, in the case of selling a loan, you could forgive it, and that would be the case by mamad shloshtam as well. There, the chachamim instituted that you don't have a right to do it in order to facilitate commerce. The whole idea of mamad shloshtam was to make it easier to do commerce, easier to pass on trade credits or outstanding trade loans, and therefore, if you're facilitating it, part of that facilitation has to be that the other party can't back out of it. And so therefore, they made it kein d'oraita in that way, which is that you don't have a right to back out of the loan. Whether you think it's d'oraita or d'rabbanan influences many of these other issues as to why it's functioning or how it functions in those other situations. The other thing is that when the person forgives the loan, what obligation does the other party have to repay it? So the Rashbam over here claims that it derives from dinei degarmi. The Baal Yad Tosafot say over here, Vomeri, Ein tzarich lachzir la ma'ot shenatnu bo lo kuchot v'lo kol ha'shtar. When he refunds the money, he doesn't have to refund the full value of the shtar, but rather just the money that was paid for the shtar. The loss that was caused over here is a loss that you put up money to buy the shtar. You bought it at a discount, obviously. And when you bought it at a discount, you were hoping to collect the full amount. So then, if original creditor forgives the loan, then the only obligation to you is what you paid for that loan, not the full amount of the loan. That is the way that the Baal Yad Tosafot say it. And then he says, based on that, and he says, even according to one who says that you're dying dinei degarmi, there is a cap on your exposure or your requirement to pay over here. The Rashbam said the same thing, which is ma'otav yachzir lo, that he has to give back his money. The Baal Yad Tosafot seemed to read that the Rashbam is saying that you have to repay the entire value of the shtar. Baal Yad Tosafot say that's not the case. You only have to refund the money that was paid for it. Even if you are dan dinei garmi, that obligation is only for the loss incurred, not the profits you would have gotten had you collected on the loan. Therefore, you have to pay him back what he paid you. You don't have to pay him the full amount of the shtar. So you can see here that there are two views as to what the obligation of the party is once you're mochel on the loan, whether the obligation is to repay the full amount of the shtar, the losses that you caused, and the lost profit, or just the losses that you caused, which is the money that he laid out for buying of this shtar. And obviously, you could have a third position, which is he owes him no money. The loss was not a direct loss, but a indirect loss that is caused by your simple forgiving of the loan. So Gemara says, Iyamar bishlom adoraita. If you think that the matnat shchimei raz midoraita, mishum hachi enu yecholim chol. That's why you can't forgive the loan. Meaning, as opposed to a person who sells the loan to another party, he has a right to forgive it. In the case of the matnat shchimirah, it's a din d'oraita, the Torah then would institute that you can move property in this manner. The Torah instituted that you can move property in this manner. And therefore, it's efficacious to the point where you can't forgive the loan. The original malva, the original creditor, can't fail the loan. Eloyimar d'rabonani, amayinu yecholim chol. If it's a din d'rabonan, why can't he forgive it? So that the belief of the Gemara over here is that if it is the Rabbonon, that's what grants you the right of Mechila. So that influences those Shitot that believe that the selling of a loan is the Rabbanan, because here the Gemara says if it's the Rabbonon, then you can forgive the loan, from the case of Shchemera. So similarly, you could say the same thing by the person who sold the loan. The reason you can forgive it is because it is the Rabbonon. That seems to be the distinction that the Gemara is making over here. Algeris, the Rabbeinu Tam, disagrees with that and says it's d'oraita. And what he is saying over here is, Imad Bishloma d'oraita, is how was the Matnat Shchimera instituted? If it's instituted in a manner, has a Torah constitution to it, So that now it looks like Yerusha, which we already said works midoraita to transfer the ownership from the bequeather to the inheritor without any residual rights being left behind, to the point that you can't forgive? Or is it simply a din derabanan where you would be able to forgive the loan? That is a problem for Rav Nachman, because Rav Nachman now said before that matnat shchemim is midrabanan, and we just concluded that if it's midrabanan, then you can be mochel. And we said that a matnat shchemira of a loan, an outstanding loan, is binding to the point where you can't be mochel on it, and that is only true if it was a din d'oraita. So now you have a stira between what seemingly is a din d'oraita here, that Rav Nachman thinks that the matnat shchemira is midoraita, versus a statement before where he says that matnat shchemira is midrabanan. Now the Rav Chanan Wasserman over here, the Kobet Shiurim, says, why does it matter that it's dirabanan? Why isn't something binding when you have a din dirabanan? For instance, kinyan mishicha. According to those that believe ma'ot konot midoraita, that money is the main vehicle for kinyan midoraita, mishicha is an institution of the chachamim in order to protect the individual who was buying it, that he isn't saying, nisraf chitecha baliyah. That, oh, you bought it and the thing caught fire, I'm sorry, you lost all your money. So that's why you use the kinyan mishicha to protect against that. But that's a kinyan midrabanan, and nobody says because it's a kinyan midrabanan you can walk away from it. So what Rav Chanan Wasserman says in the Kobet Shiurim is that there's a difference. Over there, the transaction is a transaction midoraita, because the object itself can be acquired min haTorah. The question is, which kinyan are you using in order to facilitate a transaction that would otherwise work midoraita? So therefore, if you're just changing the kinyan and making a kinyan derabonon, that kinyan derabonon will accomplish the same thing that a kinyan d'oraita will accomplish, which is that you are successful at transferring the ownership. On the other hand, in our case over here, there is no kinyan whatsoever. It's not that there's a transaction that works d'oraita, we're trying to figure out what is the mechanism from doing that, but rather the object itself is unacquirable. And that goes back to the Ramban by B'mamad Shloshtam, where he says that midoraita, there's no way you can acquire the chov, because the chov itself is not enough in your possession for you actually to transact or trade in it, and therefore could only be a din derabonon. Versus the dissenting opinions over there that viewed it as being bershuto, just an intangible asset that Mamad Shloshtam could overcome. But either of those deficits would make it that it's not an acquirable object over here. And so here, the question is, maybe the whole institution is derabanan. And therefore, when the whole institution is derabanan, that's why we might say that you could be mochel on it. It's not a din deraita that now has some extra vehicle that can be used for a kinyan, mi derabanan. It's not even a kinyan whatsoever. And therefore, it would be different in terms of how you view it. When you would say it's machul, like in our case over here by Shchemira, this is the case of kinyan mishicha, but even though it's derabanan, nobody thinks that you can walk away from that kinyan. So it says, no, eina shel Torah, basua shel Torah. No, eina chanami. He believes, Rav Nachman, that kinyan Shchemira is only midrabanan. But he says that the rabbanan, in this case, instituted that it'll have a power like it did deoraita. And therefore, the matnat shchemira is so powerful that when you transfer a debt in that manner, you will transfer it to the point where you can't be mochel. You can't forgive that loan. So even though if it was sold in that manner, you could forgive the loan. The original malveh creditor could forgive the loan. In the case of shchemira, he cannot forgive the loan once he has gifted it. Amar Rav, Amar Rav Nachman. Shchemira shamar idor ploni b'bayit zeh. He gives an instruction that so-and-so should live in this house. Yuchal ploni pirot dekel zeh, for so-and-so should be able to eat the output, the fruits of this tree. Lo amar klum. He is unsuccessful at gifting in that case. Ad shiomar, until he formulates it in the following manner. Tznu bayit zeh leploni v'yidor bo. Give the house to so-and-so in order that he should be able to live in it. Tznu dekel zeh leploni, give this palm tree to that individual, v'yuchal pirotav, and eat the pirot. So what you see here, and that the Aliyah Tosfot point this out, which is that each one of these items has a lacking in the kinyan, which is that when you're speaking about a dira, that's a davar she'en bo mamash. That is intangible asset. So-and-so should live in this house or in my house. That living is an intangible asset. A shchemira does not have the ability to pass an intangible asset to another party. Therefore, the only way to say it is to say you can have the house in order to live in it. You can't just simply say someone should live in it because that's an intangible asset. Number two is the case of Perot Dekel. Perot Dekel is not a intangible asset, but rather Davar Shelo Bali Olam, something that's yet to exist. It only exists in the future. And therefore, Davar Shebo Olam is also a lack in Kinyan, and Shchemira is unable to then gift Davar Shelo Bali Olam. And that's why only if he says you can take the Dekel, which is already Bali Olam, for its fruits, that works, because then you gave him a tangible item that is currently present, a current asset, that's a current asset, and you're using that to gift him the fruits that are derivatives of that tree, and that would work. So here, the deficit is either that it's an intangible asset, or it's an asset that has yet to exist. And that's why Rav Amenachman say if you gift such items, you fail. If you gift it with a tangible item along with it, or an asset that's current, then it will work, or then it will function. The Gemara says from this statement, the Memra de Sover of Nachman, from this you would conclude that Rav Nachman believes, Milta de Ita Babari Ita Bishchemera. If there is such a concept or a kinyan by a person who's healthy, then the Shchemera would be able to do the same thing. That is because Divrei Shchemera Kiktuvim Umisurim Damu, that they are like they are written and given over, Va'alimei Matnat Bari. They're stronger than a regular Matnat Bari, and therefore we saw before that you're unable to be Mochel on the outstanding credit document, but also over here, you can only functionally do what you could have done as a Bari. We will say that you don't need to write it down. You don't need a formal kinyan. But you can only accomplish a kinyan that otherwise a healthy person could do with those protocols or with those, with the provisions of a kinyan or the writing of a document. And so therefore the Shchemira is limited to the successful kinyanim of a Bari. Because all the Shchemira has over a Bari is that his Amira is the equivalent of a kinyan. So if it can work with a kinyan and a bari, it can work by a mirah, by a shikamirah, and the opposite is true as well, which is that the leta babari, something that a bari cannot accomplish, leta b'shikamirah. You cannot accomplish it with a shikamirah, and that's based on what he said before, that intangible assets, which in a bari can't use a kinyan to transfer, as well as the vashu lo bali olam, which again, a bari can't overcome that problem through a kinyan, so too, when it comes to a Shchemira, he will not be able to overcome those problems through Dibor, through speaking, because his speaking just replaces the Kinyan of the Bari. But the Kinyan of the Bari was not sufficient here. And that's why we would say that there is some correlation between the success of a Kinyan of a Bari to the success that a Shchemira will have in that case without the Kinyan at accomplishing that we want to do. Obviously, the Gemara now is going to challenge this principle that seemingly derives from the statement of Nachman, and we'll continue with that tomorrow on the last line of Kuf Mem Zayin Amud Bet, where the Gemara then brings statements that seem to disagree with that principle.